Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Jody Cowan.
And I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin by speaking with Ariel Smirnoff of New York Renews about New York State lawmakers' failure to pass any major climate legislation. Then Moses Nagel speaks with Zachary Simpson for an overview of who's running in the Cowman Council races throughout the city of Albany. Later on, Deborah Garrett and Jerry Ford join us to tell us about the upcoming weekend's Juneteenth event. After that, we hear excerpts from last Friday's rally opposing voter repression that took place outside the Rensselaer County offices. And finally, Anissa Hussein talks with us about being a woman in STEM and founding the Capital Region's chapter of Girls Who Code. But first, here are the headlines.
The Times Union reports critics are accusing Brendan Savage, a candidate for Schenectady County Legislature, of engaging in dog whistle racial politics over a campaign mailer that insinuates his black opponent is in favor of defunding the police when he is not. Savage, a white college student whose mother used to chair the legislature, sent out a mailer touting his support for the police. His opponent, Omar McGrill, said he supports more resources for social workers, steering crisis calls to mental health workers, as well as youth mentoring and after-school programs.
The New York State Fair will open at full capacity after this year's limitations, placed earlier this year, were removed by the state.
While several bills intended to improve the family court system failed to be passed by the state legislature, the governor has appointed a 20-member commission to issue recommendations on the mental health professionals who play a crucial role in determining child custody disputes. The appointees include several advocates who argue that the family court system is inherently biased towards women, especially those that report abuse by men.
An Associated Press investigation has found that at least 1,900 U.S. military firearms were lost or stolen during the 2010s, with some resurfacing in violent crimes. This included a gun used in the 2018 kidnapping in Albany that was linked to three other crimes in the city. The military avoids providing a full accounting of the number of lost weapons. That's it for the headlines.
Climate activists are dismayed that for the second year in a row, New York State lawmakers failed to pass any major climate legislation, with bills to enact public power or halt new fossil fuel power plants not even being voted upon in committee. Mark Dunley talks about the Climate and Community Investment Act with Ariel Smirnoff of New York Renews for Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
We're joined by Ariel Smirnoff, who is the communications and digital organizer for New York Renews, a sort of broad-based environmental justice, community, labor coalition. Works on a lot of climate issues. Climate was definitely one of the things missing from the end of the session this year, but particularly a lot of people had help that was called the CCIA, sort of a polluter penalty for carbon, would be enacted. So Ariel, maybe we start off, you know, why was the CCIA important and why wasn't it enacted this year?
Sure thing. Thanks for asking. So 2 years ago in 2019, the New York State Legislature passed the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, which was a modified version of a bill that the New York Renews Coalition had been pushing called the Climate and Community Protection Act. The CLCPA, New York's climate law, sets out mandates that New York State has to meet in terms of reducing our reliance on fossil fuels, investing in renewable infrastructure, and investing in frontline communities, communities of color, and working class poor communities that are hit worst and first by pollution and the climate crisis. So we passed those mandates 2 years ago, but we need to fund them. And that's what the CCIA does, the Climate and Community Investment Act. It puts a penalty on corporate polluters, on the toxic emissions that they're putting into our air, and uses that money to meet our climate goals, to invest in creating good green jobs, to invest in communities hit hardest by the climate crisis, in public transportation, in building efficiency, in fossil workers who will be impacted by this transition. So it's a really critical piece of legislation. We got close this year, but ultimately lawmakers failed to bring it to the floor for a vote. I can't speculate why lawmakers, you know, sort of act in the way that they do. But I can say that, you know, every year that we don't get this money, that we don't pass this funding, that we don't do big transformative climate legislation, there's a real human cost to that inaction, right? New Yorkers are dying from pollution. They're dying from climate change. And that's very real. And, you know, we need the legislature and the governor to really walk the talk. They took a really good first step with the CLCPA, and now they need to keep moving and make sure that those mandates are funded and that they become real.
Now, Assemblyman Member Steve Englebright, who was the lead sponsor, chair of the Assembly Environmental Committee, lead sponsor of what became the CLCPA, you know, one of the things that he pointed out was that, you know, this bill, which would raise, about $15 billion a year, $55 a ton per carbon emissions. He said, well, I thought that would interfere with this Environmental Bond Act for $3 billion that we're trying to borrow on the ballot, not this year, but next year. And he said, I don't want to undercut the Environmental Bond Act by passing a larger carbon tax. You know, how do the groups feel about sort of that? You know, we got to do a $3 billion bond act before we can start talking about real money.
I mean, I think that, you know, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. The scale of the climate crisis is enormous and it's urgent, and we don't have time to wait, right? Science is saying that we need to be doing this now. We can't be doing this in 3 or 4 years. It needs to happen now. So, you know, the Environmental Bond Act is a great initiative. It's also not sufficient for the kind of transformative climate and climate justice investments that our state needs. We can do the Environmental Bond Act and we can do the CCIA. And we really need to be doing as much as we can, as quickly as we can to meet the needs of this moment, to meet the needs of the climate crisis. Because, you know, as I said, the consequences of inaction are dire and severe.
You know, another argument advanced by some legislators is that as part of the CLCPA, you know, they created this 3.5 year long process for Climate Action Council to develop, you know, sort of a scope and plan to guide the state. And they wanted to see, you know, where the Climate Action Council stood on the carbon tax. And I know New York Renews has been and has members on the Climate Action Council. You know, has the Climate Action Council given an indication that something like the CCIA is going to be something they're going to recommend that the state do?
I'm not sure. You know, the Climate Action Council has been doing a lot of really meaningful and thoughtful work, particularly the council and the advisory panels to sort of come up with ways for our state to move forward on our climate and equity mandates. You know, my answer here is sort of similar to the answer that I gave to the question about the Environmental Bond Act, which is, you know, we can and we must do both simultaneously, right? The Climate Action Council has to continue its process. We're going to be moving into the place where their advisory panels are submitting recommendations. We'll be entering a period of public feedback. That's all really critical. And while we do that, we need to make sure that we're setting up ways for us to have dedicated revenue, dedicated funding to meet these climate and equity mandates, to meet and exceed them. So, you know, I think the Climate Action Council is doing a lot of really good work. And, you know, the scale of the crisis is vast. The urgency is sort of well felt by anyone who is paying attention to both sort of the scientific consensus around climate change, but also paying attention to, you know, the lived realities of communities across the state where people are suffering from asthma, from heart disease, from pollution-related illness. So we need to both respect the process of the Climate Action Council, support the process of the Climate Action Council, and advocate for, you know, true solutions, just solutions in that body, while also passing the CCIA. We have to do both.
Now, a lot of people thought that one of the best things about the CLCPA, though the governor did unfortunately weaken it at the very end, you know, was a goal of trying to get 35% to 40% of new climate funding to go to disadvantaged communities. People in the Capital District have been interested. What does that mean? Since the state is given a $200 million subsidy for an offshore wind manufacturing facility at the Port of Albany, and people would like to see you know, $70 million go into the South End and other low-income communities. Has 2 years after this bill has passed, is there really much guidance yet about how that 35% goal for disadvantaged communities is going to play out in the real world? You know, what's the Climate Action Council said about it so far?
For sure. Yeah, the Climate Justice Working Group is another body that was constituted by the CLCPA. And that's the group that's doing the most work in terms of defining defining what communities we might be looking at. You know, there is some kind of vision to this, right? We're talking about communities that have been historically overburdened by pollution by climate change that overlaps significantly with communities of color and poor and working class communities because of histories of redlining, of governments and companies citing polluting infrastructure like freeways, waste transfer stations, power plants in communities of color. So I think, you know, while the Climate Action Council and the Climate Justice Working Group are still working out the like sort of precise details of this, what is sort of meant and intended by that disadvantaged community investment mandate is pretty clear, right? We're talking about folks that are disproportionately impacted by pollution, disproportionately impacted by climate change, you know, by virtue of living in flood zones and urban heat islands, and you know, working class communities, poor communities, and communities of color.
So we've been talking to Ariel Smirnoff, communications and digital organizer for New York Renews, particularly about the Climate and Community Investment Act, which did not pass this, this session. So in the last 30 seconds, Ariel, where does the climate groups go from here in terms of trying to get this polluter penalty carbon tax enacted?
Absolutely. You know, we got we made a lot of progress this year, right? We reached almost majority sponsorship in both houses of the legislature. We built power across the state. We had, you know, dozens and dozens and of lobby visits and actions. And the fight just has to continue, right? The legislature let us down this year, and we can't let that happen again. So we're going to be continuing to organize, continuing to mobilize, continuing to lobby to try to get this over the finish line just as soon as we can.
We're out of time. Get a website?
NYRenews.org.
Thank you very much. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
We just heard Ariel Smirnoff of New York Renews speaking with Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Mark Dunley about the Climate and Community Investment Act, which failed to pass this year again. To lend support or discover more information on environmental justice, visit nyrenews.org.
The Democratic primaries for the Albany Common Council are on June 22nd, with early voting already underway. Five wards will have new members this year as the incumbents step down. HMM's Moses Nagel spoke with Zachary Simpson for an overview of just who is running in the races throughout the city.
Zachary Simpson, Albany native and founder and coordinator of the Uptown Neighborhood Cooperative and chairman of CANA. What is CANA and what have you been doing this election cycle?
So CANA is the Council of Albany Neighborhood Associations. I'm in my sixth month of my first term, and it's been around since 1976, and it's our citywide federation of neighborhood associations. For those that don't know, we have almost 30 of them in the entire city, and we have 23 that are part of CANA. And I have been doing Meet the Candidate Nights and Forums since back in February of this year.
This election cycle, we have five long-serving council members that are not running again for a new term, right?
Yes. So the five are the sixth ward, which is Richard Conte. He is retiring. And then seventh ward is Kathy Fahey. And then the ninth ward is Judy Doshea. And then ward 12, which is actually the ward I live in, Michael Bryan is retiring. And then the ward 14 is Joe Igo.
That's probably a lot for a cycle, right?
Well, I can certainly comment on 2017, which was the last cycle, which about half the council turned
over. Oh, so it's not necessarily a lot.
It's not an unprecedented number per se, but when you look at the institutional knowledge of these five individuals and the cumulative number of years that they've served on the city council, you know, it is a loss, but I'm sure they'll be around. There's always a learning curve. I've seen it firsthand in 2017, but everybody gets up to speed eventually.
So you want to start with the sixth ward numerically, and also because that's the one that seems like it's got the most candidates running, right?
Yes. And, you know, as I mentioned, we did a forum back in February through the Uptown Cooperative, co-sponsored by the Park South Neighborhood and Helderberg. And the sixth ward was one of the wards we focused on. At that time, there were five candidates in the running. Gabriella Romero, Jeff Mayo, Susan Petto, Ford McLean, and Richard Olivier Marius. As of today, there's three left. Mr. McLean, he left the race, I want to say back maybe towards the end of February, early March. And Mr. Marius actually left the race recently, within the last week or two, I think.
And Mr. Marius endorsed Gabriella Romero when he left the race. Is that right?
Yes. I think the same with Mr. McLean as well. I think they both are supporting Ms. Romero at the time, this time.
Okay. So what can you tell me about the three candidates that are left?
So two of them are attorneys. Jeff Mayo, he has worked with, I think, tenant rights and like civil rights. That's his main focus. And Gabriella Romero, I think, is a assistant public defender, I believe. And then Susan Petto, I believe her employment is with the University at Albany School of Business. So I think she's part of the faculty there.
And when they spoke at the forum, what were the big issues that they all felt were important, or what were the ones they had disagreements on?
The recent one, which was co-sponsored by, you know, CANA, the League of Women Voters, the focus churches of the Sixth Ward and Capital District Latinos. One of the big focuses was the lights in the park issue. It seems like they're all in pretty much agreement that it's outgrown its space and it needs to be relocated. So that's something they're in agreement with. You know, but there was a lot of other things asked about, you know, law enforcement. I think, you know, that's a big issue right now with the police department and, you know, the incident at the South Station. But yeah, a lot of things that were relevant to the Sixth Ward, walkability, traffic, small business. I think at this point, it's just, you know, they're going to knock doors and try to get the word out as much as possible to the potential voters in the Sixth Ward. And the Sixth Ward is very unique because it's such a compact ward. It's very urban. The four neighborhood associations around the park, they have a very tight alliance with each other, as well as with the Washington Park Conservancy. So, you know, that's unique about the Sixth, is that it's very compact and it's a lot of rental. So you got to really work hard to, I think, to get with the voters.
All right, let's talk about the Seventh then. I also spoke to the three people in this race. So tell me what you think about them.
So the three in the Seventh, that's Violetta DeRosa, Sergio Adams, and Brian Scavo, who I believe formerly served in a political position, possibly county legislature. You know, he's putting his hat in the ring. You know, I've met both Violetta and Sergio. They were part of our forum back in February. And they're both, you know, trying to get their face out there with volunteering, with knocking doors. So that'll be an interesting one to watch.
Okay. Let's talk about the 12th ward next.
So Hyde Clark. So I'm also vice president of our neighborhood association. Hyde's our president. So I do serve with him. I also serve with him on the Albany County Democratic Committee. I know him well, and I think he's going to be an excellent replacement for Councilman O'Brien. But I believe there is a Republican opponent. So we will possibly have a forum with these two individuals to talk about the issues.
I see. Okay. So he's running unopposed in the primary, but he may have a race to run in the general.
Correct.
Okay. We skipped over the 9th ward.
The 9th ward is, there's three candidates. Megan Keegan is a Democrat, Jolene Gallagher, Democrat, and then Robert Barr Porter is a Republican. So actually, CANA is doing next Tuesday a 9th ward forum with Ms. Keegan and Mr. Porter. And unfortunately, Ms. Gallagher did decline an invitation. I think both Ms. Gallagher and Ms. Keegan have been in Albany for a long time. and involved with local politics. So, but they both participated in the February forum. We got a chance to see them both together back then.
And the last one we got is the 14th Ward.
So that's Celia Evers and Deborah Zamer. They're running for the Democratic nomination. And there's actually going to be a cane event on Monday night for Ms. Zamer. Ms. Evers as well did not, she declined the invitation to participate. So we are going to Monday do a more of a town style format where it's one candidate appearing. So we're going to, take some questions from beforehand and also take questions directly from the audience.
Early voting starts pretty soon, right?
Yes, June 12th to the 20th. Check with the Albany County Board of Elections just to make sure you got the right voting polling site if you're not sure.
Tell us exactly where to find the upcoming forums that you're hosting.
Sure. So you can watch some of the reruns on the Cana Facebook page. We did the Merrill Forum. We did Ward 6. We actually did Ward 5. I was the moderator this week for the Ward 5. Forum with Jamel Robinson and Wilmer Lawson. So Ward 7, I'm sure that's going to be posted pretty soon once it's available. The 14th Ward, Ms. Zamer, will be Monday night at 6 o'clock. And then Tuesday night will be the 9th Ward with Ms. Keegan and Mr. Porter. If you would like to get an invitation to actually be present in the Zoom conference, you can send an email to Cana, that's a C-A-N-A, the number 4, albany@gmail.com. And it's also going to be streamed to YouTube and Facebook. So if you want to go to the Cana Facebook page, you can watch it there.
Anything you want to add about special challenges this year or things that are different?
The one thing I just want to say is that, these forums, these virtual forums that we're doing are just so important, particularly during the age of COVID, because last year and, this year, a lot of it has been very difficult for candidates to try to, knock doors, get people that are very hesitant about COVID because, you have people that will not open their door under any circumstances during COVID. It's been a lot of challenges. So, one thing I'll say for this year and going forward is, candidates really need to take advantage of these opportunities to, really make themselves available to the voter and get the voter an opportunity to really ask you some questions and see how you handle yourself. That's part of this process. You have to make yourself available. You have to show people how you're going to really handle yourself once you're elected. How are you going to serve? How are you going to answer tough questions? Because, getting elected is one thing, but it's to serve, it's another. And I'll tell you right now, the Common Council is it's a part-time job, but it's a full-time job if you want it to be. And there's a lot of challenges in each ward. You have to be responsive and you have to be a solutions person.
Zachary Simpson, thanks so much for talking with me. Reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, this is Moses Nagel.
We just heard Zachary Simpson, chairman of Council of Albany Neighborhood Associations, speaking with Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Moses Nagel. The Democratic primaries for the Albany's Common Council are on June 22nd. Albany residents can view more information and who's running and where to vote early at albanycounty.com.
For those just tuning in, I'm Jody Cowan.
And I'm Sina Pazila-Hickey. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, coming from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
Our mission is to use art and participatory action to promote social and environmental justice and freedom of creative expression. This program is produced by community members and funded in part by monthly donations from Sanctuary Sustainers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or call 518-272-2390. June 19th is Juneteenth, a celebration to mark the end of slavery in the USA. Renee Powell of the Troy chapter of the NAACP spoke with Deborah Garrett and Jerry Ford about how Troy will be marking this event.
Welcome to Lifting Voices. I am your host, Renee Powell, president of the Troy branch of the NAACP. And today our guests are Deborah Garrett and Jerry Ford. And we're going to talk about the Juneteenth event that will be happening on June 19th in Troy. Now, Deborah Garrett is the mother of four industrious young citizens of Troy. She's the founder of Shades of Cocoa, a former city council member, and a member of the Troy Coalition of Black Leaders, which is a community activist group that focuses on social justice. Our other guest, Mr. Jerry Ford, is the executive director of Team Hero, which is based in Troy, New York, and he is also the co-founder of this organization along with his wife. And Jerry is the father of three energetic young people, and he is also a member of the Troy Coalition of Black Leaders. Welcome, Jerry and Deborah. Thank you for participating in this.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for the invite.
Hello, hello. Thank you for having us.
Yes, yes. So for those who are not familiar with Juneteenth, I just want to give a brief summary of what it's about. So Juneteenth, which goes by other names such as a Jubilee Day, Freedom Day, was first celebrated in 1865, and this celebration was to honor the end of slavery. Now, although the Emancipation Proclamation, which freed African slaves, was signed in 1863, it took 2 years for that message to get to the enslaved Africans in Texas. And so in 1865, that message was delivered and that the first celebration took place. So now here we are in Troy, and we are going to continue that celebration and that acknowledgement of the end of slavery, and also to acknowledge the progress that has been made in the Black community. I want to start off with the question for Jerry. And Jerry, how did we get started with Juneteenth here in Troy, New York?
Well, that is a beautiful question. Every time I think about it, it just, you know, just makes me, you know, smile, because it started off as the NAACP Troy branch called a prayer meeting. We thought it was very necessary to have a prayer meeting. We were just coming off the heels of the murder of George Floyd. Gun violence in the city of Troy had taken an astronomical hike. We were losing a lot of our young people. They were being shot and killed here in our city. And we were just coming off with the heels of the historical Black Lives Matter march here in Troy, where 11,000 people showed up for a peaceful protest. And so the prayer meeting, once the call went out for the prayer meeting, it just evolved into a whole celebration of music, food, festivities, and a great example of what happens when community members come together.
Yes, yes, that was a phenomenal moment. I know when we first came up with that idea and we reached out to you, what this morphed into was just unbelievable. It was very heartwarming, and it was something to bring you to tears. It was just that special. So what can we expect this year from the Juneteenth event that's going to happen here in Troy? Deborah?
The Juneteenth event this year is going to be a little different from last year, but you know, they both was going to be special. But this year we get a chance to dedicate the 7th Avenue Park to Ms. Geneva Pompey. She's a staple in the community, and it's important that, for one, we recognize her works in the community, and as well as understanding that it's important that it's being done on Juneteenth. It almost feels like a full circle, so to speak. So we're going to do that at 10 a.m. There will be a few basketball games taking place. We'll have a libation going on. We'll also have a kids' corner. And there's going to be music and live band, DJ, dancing, food, you know, and the kids' corner is going to be at the park. But we're also going to have vendors at the park where they can you know, sell, especially Black owned businesses, where they can come out and share their businesses and share their products and pretty much get to know the community. So it's going to be a huge celebration just with the community coming together and working as one and having fun.
Well, that sounds exciting. I'm really looking forward to this. And we will be there, rain or shine. This is going to be a great day. Can you give me more detail? You've outlined the activities that will be there, but can you give me more information about the date, the time, and the location?
Yes. So I'm going to actually pull up the flyer so I can read it right from the flyer. I don't want to leave nothing out.
Okay.
So it will be June 19th, and we will be having, so from 10 a.m. until 10 to 12 is going to be designated for the actual dedication of the park for Miss Geneva Pompey. From 12, we're going to start the libation, and then the basketball tournament will start at 2 p.m. and that'll last until about 4. The live band and the DJs playing throughout the day, but we will have a dance group dancing, the Troy dance group performing. We'll have the DJs there, you know, different DJs mixing it up throughout the day. And it's just going to be like towards the end, it's going to be a party, like old school block party celebration.
Excellent. Exciting. Is there anything else you would like to add, Jerry, to the lineup?
This year, we will be changing our venue. Last year, we was down at the riverfront. And so this year, both of you did mention that it's going to be at the park, but it's just extra special because this is the official unveiling of the newly renovated 7th Avenue Park, which is located on 7th and Ingalls. And so that Saturday, it will be dedicated to Miss Geneva Pompey, who has watched over the park and been a very, very strong pillar of our village here in Troy. So that just makes it even more special because it actually embodies, you know, what Juneteenth stands for, the strength, you know, that us African-Americans had to endure to make it through the whole period of slavery. And so that, you know, that's definitely going to be something special. I just want to add in also, there is a newly installed splash pad there. So make sure you have your babies, they bring out their bathing suits and, you know, their swim clothes, because we're definitely going to have a great time.
So, Deborah, let me ask you this. I know that you've taken, you know, the major lead on pulling a lot of this together.
Yes, are there thank you.
Yeah. Are there still opportunities for vendors to participate in the Juneteenth event?
Absolutely. I would take a vendor's application up until the night before, honestly, because we want to include everybody in the community. We do not want to leave no one out, especially because it's about celebrating Black and brown people. And, you know, we want to celebrate us. So if anyone is still interested in becoming a vendor for that day, you can either contact us through the social media event page, or you can email us at troycoalitionofblackleaders@gmail.com. And I'll say that again, it's troycoalitionofblackleaders@gmail.com. And that is troycoalitionofblackleaders@gmail.com. And that's troycoalitionofblackleaders@gmail.com.
Thank you. Is there anything else that you guys would like to add?
I definitely hope that we get a lot of people to come out. You know, we want to celebrate us, and that's the main important thing. And it's always fun when you got food and music and you can just celebrate, you know, with people that you have to see every day when you go to Walmart or in your community. So,
yeah. I don't remember if we said this, but there will be food available. There will be free food and cool drinks on that day.
Hopefully some ice cream also. We're looking for. And yeah, with that being said, we do want to thank all of our sponsors and donors. So we do have a plethora of sponsors and donors who stepped up to the table, who donated monetarily, but who also donated time and their services and the volunteers. So we do want to give them a shout out too.
Excellent. Excellent. Yes. The donations have been very generous, and thank you very much for that to the community. Well, guys, thank you so much for participating and doing the work to bring this to the community. I know it's been a long road. It's going to be an awesome event because it's coming from the heart. I want to thank you all again and have a great evening.
Thank you.
That was Renee Powell speaking with Deborah Garrett, founder of Shades of Coco and member of Troy Coalition of Black Leaders, and Jerry Ford, founder and director of Team Hero, about the Juneteenth event happening this weekend in Troy.
At 1 o'clock Friday, the 11th of June, a rally opposing voter repression was taking place outside Rensselaer County offices. HMM correspondent Andrea Cunliffe was there recording speeches and comments by concerned residents. Excerpts here are from Deacon Jerry Ford, Tashika Medina, D. Collins, Stephen Figueroa, Peter Grimm, Nora McDowell, Melissa Bromley, Emily Men, and Phil Markham.
Deacon Jerry Ford, he is the co-founder of Team Hero.
So thank you for this great turnout, everybody coming up this afternoon to address this issue that we've been fighting for so long. I too was with Ms. Renee Powell in the chamber when we went and we spoke to the county in regards to early voting access. So this has been a long fight for a lot of us. And we're starting to see that this is very deliberate.
Yes.
It's not happenstance, it's not, you know, somebody is not paying attention. This is a very deliberate act that is going on. And you know why? Because voting equals all of us. All of us standing here, white, black, rich, poor, all of us, Democrats and Republicans, voting equals all of us. And so when we talk about early voting and access to voting, that's when there are certain accommodations need to be met so that everybody can get to the polls, especially with disability. People that work, who don't have the opportunity to take off work, who have transportation challenges, the early voting really benefits these people. And right now, we are seeing that this is being denied.
That's right.
This is being denied.
Yes. Yes.
And when the AG has to step in to make a change, come on, that's sad. Elected officials have the obligation to do what the people say. So if you can't do what the people say, you shouldn't be in the office.
That's right.
Simple as that. I'm here to encourage everyone to let you know that your vote counts. Last year, we came up with Souls to the Polls, which was a great collaboration of different organizations to take people up to the meeting hall. And they call it South Troy, but it's really like Southeast Troy. And the reason why we had to do that, because it wasn't accessible. And even with those buses, we still had people that had challenges. And so then what did we do? We started doing car rides to the polls. We're going to do whatever it takes to make sure
that's
everybody
right.
has equal access.
That's right.
This note, as the great Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, it's always the right time to do what is right. And here we stand.
Yeah. Thank you, Deacon Jerry Ford.
Next. Tashika Medina, the founder of Equality for Troy.
Hey, Tashika!
So, we're not gonna let them take our voice.
That's right.
Like the brother said, if we gotta get buses, if we gotta get cabs, if we gotta do whatever we gonna do to make our voice heard, we are going to be heard. This is a deliberate attempt. And voter confusion is what?
Voter suppression.
It certainly is. And Rensselaer County, we on to you. You are literally doing this on purpose. We just want equal rights. We just want our voice heard. If we put you in office, we can certainly get you out. So we gotta keep this going. And when we say that we need help to get these people up to these voting sites, I need you guys to really come together collectively in solidarity so we can let our voices be heard. And thank you so much for letting my voice be heard today.
What I would do is open up the mic. It is up to you if you would like to come and to speak. I wanted to at least open it up to about four candidates if they would like to speak of voter suppression, because this is actually impacting them.
Just said this is not just a Troy issue. But let me be clear. Our candidates who are running in the city of Troy are at a significant disadvantage because here is our densely populated voters. And when we keep them away from the polls, listen, I'm a kid of the 60s, so I know what it's like to have to stand in front of my bodega, in front of my church, in front of my community center to get that ride to take me where I need to go. At the same time that I gotta worry about my kids getting picked up from school, my mom getting to the store, all the things that we take for granted as voters. The people who need to get to the polls need us to get them there. They need to be able to do it on their own time, on their own dime, and we have kept that away from this. This is not acceptable. It is not acceptable in the United States of America. It is not acceptable in Rensselaer County. We are going to be the voice of change.
My name is Dee Collin Charleston, and as the running for City Council District 1, I'm also a Black woman.
Come on.
I'm also someone who rides the bus. I'm also someone who did not go to the Armenian church. From where I live in Lansingburg, it takes two buses and almost a 10-minute walk to get there.
That's not access.
If the site was Unity House, that would cut my time and effort more than half. If you look at the candidates that are running in Troy, a number of people of color running for office. Yes. That's something to really notice. So when Rensselaer County Board of Elections decides to not adhere to the law and they drag their feet on reconciling the fact that we need a location that's accessible and easy for people to get to vote. We should be encouraging people to vote.
That's right.
Not dismissing the fact that we want to engage in the voting process. So at this point, I can say that it's intentional. It's intentional because they've noticed who's running for office. And it means something. Everybody in the city of Troy to be able to vote how they want to vote. So that voting process is fair. Yeah.
Thank you, Dee. I'm Stephen Figueroa. That's running for City Council District 2.
I'm just gonna keep it short and simple, okay? There's no way that we shouldn't have access as taxpayers, as residents. We work so hard in the city of Troy to not have access to early voting sites. And as we all know, elections is right around the corner. When you're in that voting poll, make sure that you know who you vote for.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Stephen. Peter?
Thank you. I'll be brief as well, frankly. It should not be this hard for people to have the right to vote. This is what we're all about. Democracy is all about, is having the right to vote. They're afraid that they won't have the power that they have anymore, and it is all about power. Well, the real power is here. Right. Yeah. This election year is probably one of the most critical elections that has happened in the city of Troy. We have changed. Our demographics has changed. Our complexion has changed.
Say that.
We are a different city now, and we have different needs, and we deserve rights. Thank you very much.
So next up is Nora McDowell.
Young people need to vote. I've always encouraged kids to vote. I've loved doing it, whether it's through the club, Girls Inc., when I was working for ARC, and we're making it harder for them to vote their first voting time. Moms need to vote. They need to be able to get the kids in the stroller and get to the polls. They need to not be confused as to what day it is, where it is, what's gonna happen. Voter confusion is voter suppression.
That's right.
Get whatever help you need to vote, but we shouldn't have to work so hard. Sometimes the primary election is the election. So be ready. Use whatever way you can vote. Just vote.
Yeah. Yeah. Go voter.
Thank you, Nora. I have space for two more people.
I'll go.
This is just confusing to me. What is going on here? Do we have any good answer for why we don't have an early voting location in the heart of Troy?
Racism! White supremacy!
Who stands to benefit from denying the center of Troy an early voting site? I will say, you know, we know that that is where the highest concentration of low-income voters are, highest concentration of voters of color, black voters, disproportionately Democratic voters. I would like to know why Rensselaer County commissioners on both sides of the aisle are not supporting an early voting site in the heart of Troy, and then what do the voters get to do about that?
Thank you. I'm Emily Mann. I'm a Democratic candidate for Downtown District 4. It is our patriotic duty as Americans to fight for the votes of all. To take it from one person is to take it from all. Veterans, blood has been shed. Blood has been shed in this county for the right to vote. Generations of Americans have died for the right to vote. They've died in the South. They've gotten on buses to put their lives on the line to vote. I've registered hundreds of people to vote. And I encourage you, if you look like me, if you have resources, if you have transportation, if you have time, if you can provide childcare, if you can open up your heart and get someone to the polls until this is corrected, and it will be corrected, because we're the ones that pay the salaries behind these doors. It is our fundamental right to vote, and we will not stop. Thank you.
I'm Phil Markham of the Working Families Party, and just ask everybody to try to get locally involved. That we have little groups, clubs. There's all sorts of things that we can do to get the people involved. Don't just go out and vote. It's not that hard, really, to get 100 people to vote. So do it. Thanks.
Thank you, Emily. Thank you, Phil. I just want to say, Melissa, you're amazing. And I just want to repeat these words three times. If your vote didn't matter, they wouldn't work so hard to suppress it. If your vote
didn't matter,
they wouldn't work so hard to suppress it. If your vote didn't matter, they wouldn't work so hard to suppress it.
Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Andrea Cunliffe brought us that segment from a rally opposing voter repression outside the Rensselaer County offices. Early voting has started in Troy, and thanks to voices from the community, downtown Troy's Board of Elections will now be a fourth voting location.
Anissa Hussein founded the Capital Region's chapter of Girls Who Code in 2019 and hopes to inspire young girls to get into coding and technology. Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Sally Becker spoke with Hussein about her organization and being a woman in STEM.
I'm Sally Becker from the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and today I'm speaking with Anissa Hussein, the founder of Girls Who Code Capital Region. Thank you so much for talking with me today, Anissa.
Hi, thanks, Sally. Thanks for having me.
So tell me a bit about your background and what led you to put together Girls Who Code.
Yeah, thanks. So I have a degree in cybersecurity and communications. And, you know, throughout my career and throughout my degree program, it's really just been a very visual representation of majority males being in the workforce and not as many females. So that happened for me in my college classes, at work, on my teams, you know, on security teams. And, you know, in 2019, I realized that in the Albany area here, we didn't really have a dedicated club for girls to learn coding and technology. And Girls Who Code, you know, the national organization founded by Reshma Sajani is amazing. So I was like, oh, how great if we could have a chapter here. So I founded the chapter in 2019. And, you know, we've had such a high member base since then. But it's just such a huge passion of mine to see these girls completely thrive in technology when they never thought that they were ever good at something like that. And they never thought that they can see themselves do it. And then during our club, they'll be like, oh my God, I'm so good at this. I love it. And they just practice on their own without me even having to assign anything. And it just makes the motivation just, you know, it just makes me want to keep doing it forever.
What would you describe as the like main mission for your organization? And how do you guys go about like helping these girls?
Yeah, so main mission is definitely, it's twofold. So the first is teaching a programming language. And in my either in our 2019 year and our 2020 to 2021 year. We focused on both Python and HTML. So those were our two languages. Those are the most common, and I think they're easier for middle schoolers to grasp. Especially, I mean, we have some elementary schoolers, you know, third and fourth graders who are joining with the big girls. And, you know, so we try to keep it easier, you know, in there. They're both extremely robust languages. But the second part of the mission is really creating that sisterhood and creating that bond. And, you know, I really tried to hone that so far, you know, during my meetings. So really, like, and so at the end of every club meeting, for example, we have a club member shout out. So each girl has to shout out a member for something that they did and help them, or something that they saw on the sidelines that meant a lot to them. And it's so amazing because these girls are like, what, you noticed that or whatever. I'm not even making this up. Like, a few girls literally became best friends after being in my club, being in this club. And like, and I paired them together the first meeting, and I was like, you guys, and they went to the same school, they were in the same grade, and they had no idea. They went to Shen in Clifton Park, which is a large school for those of you who know, and they had no idea. And Sonia and Naja, if you're listening to this, I'm referring to you. And I called them out and I was like, you guys are going to be best friends, watch. And they did. They struggled together. They learned programming together, and they became friends outside of school, outside of the club. But really, that's just a testament to the part of this, right? Because it's not, because technology and coding, it has such a stigma, like, oh, it's hood up, guys only, boring technical talk, that's it, right? No, we have fun, we have girl time, like, but whatever that means, you know, whatever that means to anyone. And it's such an inclusive environment. I think that was the important thing, because I had third graders coding with 11th graders. How do you facilitate that boundary in a classroom? It was just me when that was happening. Like, for our first year, it was just me for like 30 something girls. So ranging from fourth grade to like 12th grade. So, you know, maintaining that balance and that safe space, so a third grader understands that you can ask a question and an 11th grader can understand. You can also ask a question. It doesn't matter if a third grader gives you an answer. So it's having that baseline, like, we're all here to learn something despite our age, despite our background. And I think that was the whole second piece, which just really brought everything together, which just makes me so happy.
What do you see as the biggest challenge for women in tech, or even just in STEM in general?
The biggest challenge is not speaking up, I think. I think it's very easy to get lost in the weeds or get lost in someone speaking over you, someone mansplaining, let's say. I think it's very easy to let that happen without saying anything about it or without speaking up a little bit more, you know? And I'm when I say speak up, I mean that literally and figuratively, because sometimes mansplaining includes someone speaking loudly or someone trying to speak over you, literally. So sometimes you just have to keep speaking, and that's very hard. That was really hard for me to learn. So like, my first security team was, it was 11 of us, and I was the only female. I was the youngest, and I was one of two minorities, and that's it, you know, like that was it. So, and in the entire tech team in general, there were like 25% female, probably 75% male. So it was a lot of like, okay, are you the secretary? Are you the note taker? Like, what are you here for? It's like, no, I'm here for the technical stuff too. You know, I'm on the security team. But yeah, I think really the biggest challenge is letting that like overcome you so much so that you don't want to continue pursuing the field. Because I really hope that doesn't happen to people, because it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough because females are in the minority. You know, female identifying folks are in the minority within cybersecurity, especially. Right now, I think the percentage is like 26% of the field is female as of 2021 or something. So, and that only went up from like 22% back in 2016 when I graduated. So it's not like we're going up by boundaries. But that's improvement, right? That's change. And I think understanding, like, you just have to understand as a female, if you're pursuing cybersecurity, you're not going to be, not many people are going to look like you in the room. Okay. You're going to be, you know, maybe feel a little left out, maybe feel like you can't make friends, or you can't find someone to connect with, but that is a challenge, you know, that that whole aspect is a challenge. And I think overcoming that, really thinking confident, thinking positive through that, you know, would kind of help you get over that, but don't let that turn you away. My initial advice really is find your niche, find what it is that you like to do, and find some way to incorporate that into security. So for myself, you know, like I started in cybersecurity. I'm still working in cybersecurity, but right now my role is a lot more writing focused. And I love to write. I love the soft skill portion as well, the project management side, that kind of thing. So find what your niche is and advocate for yourself. Like, that's my advice, because the industry does not advocate for women in cybersecurity. And it's not because the industry doesn't want to, it's because the industry is not primarily women. So how can they advocate for women, right? So I think my one piece of advice is really just be confident about your abilities. And let me also say that imposter syndrome is a real thing. Fake it till you make it is a real thing, okay? Because you have to fake it till you make it. So if I have advice, that's what I'm gonna say. Because if you don't have confidence in yourself, how are other people gonna believe in you, right? If you're doubting your abilities to be on a security team, how are your coworkers going to believe that you need to be there? I think just advocate for yourself. Be okay with not knowing something, because especially to my college grads who are going into their first full-time roles or first internships, you're not Einstein, okay? You're not security Einstein. No one is, not even someone with 20 years of experience. There's always going to be something that you don't know. So understand that it's okay to not know that. And understand that it's okay to say that you don't know something. Someone asks you a question about security and you simply don't know, be like, listen, I don't know, but I'm going to look it up and I'll get back to you on that. And actually follow through. That's the second part, right? So if there's something that you don't know that struck you, go Google it, go look it up and familiarize yourself with it. So next time you do know exactly what it is, but learn from your mistakes, because that's how you're going to grow in the field. And essentially that's how you'll gain confidence. And I think it all like ties together. But that's my advice.
To learn more about Anissa and Girls Who Code Capital Region, check out Anissa's website, Anissa with 5 E's. That's AnneeEsa.com. I'm Sally Becker with Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
That was Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Sally Becker speaking with Anissa Hussein, founder of the Capital Region's chapter of Girls Who Code.
And that concludes our show. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Jody Cowan.
And I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey, also your engineer. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community, for the community, and is supported by independent donations. Thank you to all of our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org.
This program is produced entirely by volunteers. Learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice. Email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org, through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast, and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.